Welcome to Chain Reaction. I'm Al Murray, and it's my turn to pass the Chain Reaction baton onto someone else, having been interviewed by Ed Byrne so vigorously and rigorously last week. My guest, or is it subject, I don't know, is a man who's worn many hats. Hats of all sorts of shapes, but not necessarily sizes, as, after all, they're all hats that fit him. He's a journalist, editor, satirist, comedy writer, TV star, historian. Of course, I am talking about Ian Hislop, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Chain Reaction.
Thank you. I can just hear all those historians writing writs.
We'll talk about being sued in a minute. When I look at your CV, and forgive me if I sound like an obituarist in training, my first thought is, how on earth do you have time to do everything or fit all these things in? Because you edit a national newspaper, magazine, paper. Is it a magazine, a newspaper? What is it?
Whatever you like.
Okay.
Rag.
and you write a lot of comedy. You're on Have I Got News For You half the year, aren't you? I mean,
probably, yeah.
How do you keep all these plates spinning? You must be very organised.
Yes, and also a lot of them take less time than I pretend.
Yeah, you see.
No, the answer is I'm extremely greedy. And I get offered these opportunities and I can't resist and I just want to do it all.
So you're making hay while the sun's shining?
Yes, and because I'm so old, it seems to have been shining quite a long time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because that's the thing. I mean, the first thing I want to talk about is Private Eye. I mean, as far as I can tell, you've been there forever. You got the job when you were, what, 26, is that right?
Yeah, I became editor at, it was in 1890.
Did you bring down the Gladstone government?
Yeah, we tried pretty hard. Yes, I took over as editor in 1986. I was 26. Right. So I have been there nearly three decades now.
Gosh.
You're shocked.
Well, no. I mean, because as a kind of first big job, that's a very big first big job, isn't it? It's a lot. The magazine's nationally established and famous. It must have been a big responsibility.
Yes,
you know, telling truth to power and all that.
Oh yeah,
satire stuff.
Unfortunately, I was offered the job when I was very young, and when you're very young, you're very confident. If I was offered it now, I'd say no. You've got to be kidding. But when I'm 26, they said, "Would you like to be editor of Private Eye?" I thought, "Yeah, sure, yep." And people were a bit saying, you know, "What's the next reaction? Thank you," or "That might be quite hard work." I just said, "Yeah, when do I start?"
Brilliant. Wow. And did you think you'd be doing it for 30 years? I mean,
no, I made a number of extremely pompous speeches saying, "Well, I'll probably do this for a couple of years and move on." And I haven't, in any sense.
I mean, as a long-term reader, I think I have an idea, but, I mean, where do the stories come from? Because you're a newspaper in that every 2 weeks you need stuff, need stories, but you don't get them from... I mean, I assume...
The Wire? Mail Online?
Exactly. Go look down the right-hand side of Mail Online and pluck out your stories. Where does it come from? Are we talking the disgruntled, the passed over? Who is it?
Oh, all of them. Essentially, Private Eye works as a club.
Right.
If any of you remember the old Beano Club, you belong to a magazine, you subscribe to it, and you provide it with material. The fantastic thing about the Eye's readership is they are people established in their own professions who know about things.
Yeah.
And they tell us. Our greatest investigative journalist was a man called Paul Foote. And he was asked, "What's the secret of investigative journalism?" And he used to say, "People ring me up and tell me things." That's the secret.
Right, and he'd type them up.
Yes, and the readers not only provide the stories, they provide letters, and often they prove they're funnier than we are. I mean, we ran a cartoon, which was the bipolar Grand Old Duke of York. You know, when he was up, he was up. When he was down, he was down. We thought this was pretty funny. And then we got a letter of objection, and someone said, "Dear sir, I suffer from a bipolar complaint." And I thought that cartoon was absolutely disgusting. I looked at it a few days later, thought it's really funny. Real letter.
The thing that's interesting about The Eye is there's straight-up journalism.
Yep.
There's funny cartoons, there's gags, there's satirical pastiches of stuff. In a way, what is it? Which comes first? Do people buy it for the jokes and then end up reading Rotten Boroughs, or are the jokes light relief from the tales of mismanaged bins in Birmingham?
Yes. I mean, I think were it only depressing tales of what's going wrong, we would have difficulty getting a readership.
Yeah.
But because we do the jokes, the pill is somewhat sweetened.
Right.
I mean, again, I mean, Paul Foot used to claim that people read the jokes first and then 2 weeks later they'd read his pieces when they were on the loo. I think that's pushing it. No, the original idea was you would make jokes about what people know and then you would tell them things they don't know.
Right.
And that seemed to me an amazing combination of jokes and journalism.
Yeah.
And no one else does it and no one else has ever gone there. And it seems to me a perfect formula.
Yeah. Well, it's bigger than ever, isn't it, at the moment?
Yeah, we've had a very good run. And the election is...
No, I meant the typeface.
Oh, right. Yeah, that served me right. You very nearly got the circulation figure breakdown.
So something I have to ask.
Yeah.
What's it like being sued? I've never been sued.
I thought you were sued by Farage.
No, it was kind of nearly the other way round.
Ah.
But we can't really talk about that.
So, Al, tell me more.
No. You have to get me back next week if you want to ask me that question. No, seriously, what's it like being sued? Because you've been caught up in some massive dramatic court cases and others that are probably we never even hear about.
You know, I've got a pretty good record in the courts. I must have fought 40 libel actions and won.
But what happens? I mean, you get a letter and there's the famous Prestram versus Arkell, isn't there?
Yes.
The famous reply, which, if people don't know, take us through Prestram versus Arkell.
Well, this is before my time, but there was a writ from a company called Arkell, and they sent a writ saying, you know, this is an appalling defamation, and the damages that we will be seeking, we will calibrate according to your response, to which my predecessor, Richard Ingrams, wrote, our response is off.
That comes up occasionally, doesn't it?
It does.
I refer you to Prestram versus Arkell.
Yes, we refer people to the response of Prestram versus Arkell. My predecessor, Richard Ingrams, was notoriously robust.
Yeah.
When I took over, we just had a court case in which he'd said in the witness box, the only things in Private Eye that aren't true are the apologies. Which made my negotiations rather difficult.
So you get the dread letter and then it goes to court. And you famously lost. It was the Sonia Sutcliffe case, wasn't it? Where
yes, you, thank you for bringing that up.
Well, you know, it can't all be laughs around here.
Yeah.
Where you really did end up, I mean, £600,000, was that right?
Yes. I mean, this was a writ from the wife of Peter Sutcliffe, who's a serial killer. And most people at the time were losing to popular figures in the courts, you know. Elton John, pop stars, sportsmen. I lost to, you know, the wife of a serial killer, which suggested the Eye's popularity wasn't terrifically high. I thought I'd bankrupt the magazine. It was not long after I'd taken over.
Yeah.
And I thought the damages in those days were entirely decided by a jury. It's all changed. I mean, libel has got a lot more sensible. But this was essentially the Wild West. Yeah. And the jury came up with a figure of £600,000.
God, good God.
Add to the costs, it was about £1.5 million, I'd bankrupted the magazine. We were technically trading insolvently the next day. You know, so everyone thought, oh, he's made a good job of being editor.
Yeah.
And that was the time I came out of court and I was so angry. I said, well, if that's justice... And I couldn't think of anything to say. And I said, I'm a banana. Which will probably be my epitaph. But it makes no sense.
Yeah.
And eventually we went to the appeal court and they decided it was an absurd figure.
Yeah.
And the damages were reduced to 60,000. Mm. And then they changed all the rules about what you could advise the jury and whatever. But it was a sort of madness. Personal injury. If you lost an eye or a leg or an arm or you were half dead, you got about 20 grand. On a libel writ, you could have £1 million for your reputation.
The sky was the limit, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, was that your darkest hour as editor, do you think?
There were a couple of other losses. Yeah, that was pretty dire. I just didn't want to be an idiot. Probably a bit late.
Are you right now, though, right this minute, brimful of secrets that could bring the whole rotten edifice crashing down right this minute?
No. I love the way people overestimate journalists. If we know anything, we put it in.
Right.
You know, we haven't got that much stuff.
That's reassuring. Why are you able to lead with things that other people...
Well, we have two advantages. One is we don't have any proprietors, and so we don't have influence from them, and we have an ability to repeat. So Private Eye will run a story and then run it again, and regular readers will know, and then we do it again, and then we do it again for about 5 years, and eventually someone takes notice. A recent example, we suddenly woke up to find the Prime Minister was saying, do you know, a lot of property in England is foreign-owned. Through shell companies. Have you heard of these shell companies? And I'm thinking, yes, I've been telling you about them for 5 years! And you get wins. We've got a brilliant journalist who used to be a tax inspector, and we lured him over to the dark side. And he's called Richard Brooks, and he started writing about non-doms. He started writing about large corporations that don't pay their taxes. 5 years later, this is mainstream.
Yeah.
Previously, it was him saying to me, this is a really interesting story, and I'm going, is it? Are you sure? And he goes, yeah, it is.
But that's the journalistic end of the eye.
Yeah.
Satire.
Yes.
Satire is one of these words that gets wheeled out. It's like it's got a capital S. It's like it's important. Yeah. It's almost a thing that should be in a museum even while it's happening. It's taken seriously.
Or not.
Or not. Yeah, exactly. Because I was going to say, it also is part of a long and time-honoured noble tradition of achieving not very much at all.
Yes.
I mean, how many governments have crumbled due to witty barbs?
None.
Yeah.
Peter Cook, who used to be the Eye's proprietor, said, German satire in the 30s, fantastic. That really stopped Hitler. And I have to say, you know, Jonathan Swift, the English satirist, one of my heroes, essentially could probably point to one tax in Ireland that he got revoked.
Right.
But in the end, I think it's the effort that matters.
Yes.
And what we're there for is not to topple the government. You know, that's your job. You've got to vote for it in a democracy. Yeah. We're there to sort of point up an argument, try and clarify a debate, make some points, get some laughs, and then go home.
As someone sort of, you know, I do the thing I do, I always try and make sure I'm being funny first, and if there's a point, it's clad in the funny material, is the idea. Being funny first is the aim, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, the point of the stuff we do is to try and make a point and be funny, and you've got to do two out of two.
Yeah.
You know, our readers are very keen on that.
Yeah.
They want to be informed, they want to be entertained.
Because you occasionally have a cover, and then in the letters pages, people cancel their subscriptions.
All the time.
Taste, edge... All these questions. I mean, it's certainly in stand-up comedy, there's in my line of work, there's always this argument about edge and where the boundaries are, and people often get very hung up on the idea that comedy's job is to push boundaries and that sort of thing. Mm. What do you think of this idea of edge and pushing boundaries? And
again, I mean, people saying, oh, it's edgy, it's this, you haven't got enough edge, you've lost your edge, you've got too much edge. I mean, essentially, you're just trying to say something that is absolutely on the nail, and sometimes that won't be to people's taste.
Yeah.
And they complain. They say, this is absolutely too much. But there will always be people who don't like it.
Yeah.
And the funniest thing for us is people who say, I've been reading Private Eye for 40 years, and I've never complained until now. But last week's cover about the Queen was absolutely shocking. You remember there was a scandal of her making a Nazi salute. Yes. Yeah. And we had a cover of Prince Harry leaning over to offer her comfort, saying, just tell them you were pissed. Some people find that offensive.
But the question of edge and all this sort of thing then takes us to the very dramatic situation with Charlie Hebdo, which I remember at the time trying to, you know, I think a lot of people were thinking, well, what's this the equivalent of in the UK? Yeah. And a lot of people said, well, this is like Private Eye. It's like the Eye. It's as if some gunman had gone into the Eye objecting over a cover. I mean, you know, A2 Charlie, this is the question. What do you think about what happened there?
Well, I didn't think we were Charlie. I didn't say Je suis Charlie. I mean, I supported entirely their right to print whatever they like. That I thought was absolute. But we're not the equivalent of them. I mean, this is a 1960s largely cartoon, the French left, which is much harder, which is incredibly sort of anti-religion of all types. It's an entirely different beast to the Eye. And what I wanted to do was react in our own way. So when you had that meeting of world leaders all linking arms, some of them the most unpleasant dictators on earth, some of them who'd recently had anti-press laws, one of whom, who the next day then refused to sell Charlie Hebdo in his country. He was on the march. Je suis Charlie.
Yeah.
So we ran a cover saying, Je suis charlatan.
Yeah.
over them. And I was very thrilled to find out one of the survivors, one of the cartoonists, the survivors on Charlie Hebdo said, I'm asked what we should have done the week after. And he said, we should have attacked that march.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, maybe we got something right.
Yeah. Because I like the idea that I can say what I like on stage.
Yeah.
But obviously I know there's things places I can't go or don't. I'm not comfortable with going.
Yeah.
And yet, even then, I'm not under the threat of that kind of violence. It didn't make you think, well, it's time for Private Eye to be extra fearless.
No, because, I mean, I thought that's your definition of fearless.
Yeah.
My definition of what I think satire should do and what we wanted to say did not include...
what they were doing.
What they were doing, yeah. Or reproducing what they were doing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we put the repeated cover in the end, but I was much more interested in the stuff we'd run before and our cartoonists' response now,
yeah.
Which was very different and very English.
Yeah.
A lot of the cartoonists sent in cartoonists saying, blimey, a rejection slip would have done.
I mean, isn't there a worry, though? Isn't there a worry? I mean, Punch was once the magazine yep. that did... the Eye's job, I think, arguably.
Well, in the early days, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Late 19th century.
Well, yeah, but do you not... right about when you started. Do you not worry that... Do you not worry that... Because a thing that happens to satire very often is it gets co-opted by the establishment. It gets brought in, you know.
Yeah.
You know, what defences do you throw up against that? Because arguably you are from the establishment, aren't you?
Well, most British satire comes from insiders. You know, if you look at the history of satire, Lord Byron... He was a lord.
Yeah.
Dean Swift, the Church of England.
Yeah.
He was a dean.
I mean, because I always, you know, the Eye is, for me, part of the furniture of the country. It is established, but it's not establishment. And that's quite a balancing act, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there has to come a moment. But people have been saying, oh, Private Eye sold out. Obviously not at the newsstands, that would be awesome. Since about 1964, apparently, was the first recorded incident. But... I think, you know, the measure of it is if you can still annoy people, you can still run pieces that they don't want to read, and you can still say things that people say, oh, I didn't know that, no one told me.
Yeah. Now, you're a TV star.
Yes, let's get on to safer territory.
Because again, I said earlier you wear all these different hats. You're also on Have I Got News For You, which everyone's seen, or they're one of those people who won't have a TV licence. I mean...
They don't have Dave, obviously.
Are you a celebrity in his... I put it to you in his... You are a celebrity. Are you a celebrity?
I thought I might be, but then I was on the tube recently... And one woman said, that's Ian Hislop, that's Ian Hislop, that's Ian Hislop. And the other woman said, oh, leave him alone, it looks nothing like him.
Because, I mean, you know...
So I think not famous enough.
But, I mean, what do you make of the modern business... I mean, you're meat and two veggies, politics and the like, but what do you make of the modern business of celebrity? Because, effectively, you're on the telly every week, everyone knows who you are, but you're not... But I don't. You don't seem to fall out of nightclubs...
oh, just you wait.
Yeah, what are you doing after? But seriously, I mean, I don't think it's anything new. I think we tell ourselves it's something new, but I don't think it's anything new at all.
I think the technology has just reinforced it and made it more persistent. But, I mean, there's always been some form of celebrity culture. I'm just sort of aware of a sort of an incessant interest in and attempt to co-opt celebrities into everything. And I think there have been moments in history where... there were activities that were viable without celebrities doing them.
Yeah.
Skating, dancing, baking. I mean, there were things people did that seemed to be all right. But,
and they did them a lot better than the celebrities as well. You don't fancy 2 weeks in the jungle with some Muppets?
Well, again, enforced camp with a lot of people I don't necessarily like. You know, I went to public school. I've done that.
But you've written for comedy for all sorts of people, haven't you? Tim Nice But Dim is your creation. How do you go about approaching writing for a character comedian? What's the steps required?
I mean, I did a lot of comedy writing, sketch writing, when I was sort of first starting. There was a show called Three of a Kind, and I used to write for Lenny Henry on that. And then I was asked to write something with my friend and co-writer, Nick Newman, who's a brilliant cartoonist and writer. And Harry Enfield approached it, and he said... all my characters are working class and shout a lot. Have you got anyone else? and we thought, well, there's someone we were at school with, in fact, quite a lot of people we were at school with, who was really, really nice, but very, very dim.
And the other thing you wrote a great deal of was Spitting Image, wasn't it?
Yes. Nick Newman and I, we started on Spitting Image right at the start.
I mean, that is regarded as a golden age of satire on television, isn't it? I mean, I remember it was must-watch television, but there doesn't seem to be anything...
I always resist. I think it's a sort of old man's complaint. Oh, there's nothing good on anymore. There's no politics. It's not like the old days. I think there's always something on. There's always a new generation who've got something else to say. They may do it in a different way.
I agree with you. You can't get too tangled up in this idea that things were better back then and everything worked better. But the grey John Major eating his peas...
Yes.
I mean, it didn't lose him an election, but it certainly very much fed into the...
I genuinely think it's worth making the effort. I mean, you know, I wouldn't have done it for so long.
Yeah.
I try not to overrate it, but I think it is incredibly good at sometimes making the point in a way that is absolutely remembered.
Yeah.
And some of the Thatcher stuff we did in the early years and some of the Reagan stuff, and I mean, we worked on it up until Mrs. Thatcher left office. You know, it took us 11 years, but we got her out. Or rather, she was knifed in the back by a group of old Tories. But it's the same thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, obviously I thought it was worth doing, and I loved working on Spitting Image. The only thing that I think it's worth being nostalgic about was there was a sort of bravery amongst TV executives to say, no, this is what we want to do, we will do it.
Well, maybe that's what I'm referring to, really, when I say things ain't as good as they used to be, because there seems to be a kind of cowed culture in broadcasting at the moment. People have certainly in I'm not going to mention the broadcaster, but in fact we're on it, which seems to be in a febrile nervous state. Certainly, I mean, having done enough comedy on it and enough topical stuff on it of late, where you're in this compliance
zone
or maze, I can't think what the right word is. You know, we have a compliance person stood behind the glass in case we say anything wrong during the live broadcast.
Yes, fortunately on Have I Got News For You, we try it out. Then the BBC lawyers say, well, there is a problem here. And I go, trust me, I'm very good at the law.
Now, last summer, we met after I'd appeared on a TV thing about VE Day, and you said you'd not been on it because you enjoy watching things about VE Day rather than being on them. Now, I mean, here's your other another hat. Historian is too much, but you're certainly happy to make programmes where you commentate on history and talk about...
Yeah, no, I'm a history fan.
And
I love making documentaries because you essentially get incredible access and a chance to go and talk to people you'd never get to and make programmes.
Yeah.
And I've made programmes about education, about the Church of England, a lot of programmes about trains, some other programmes about trains, a lot of programmes about the Victorians, stiff upper lip. I mean, I'm allowed to make programmes about British social history, which is one of the things I think is incredibly interesting.
Well, in the First World War, which of course is a fascinating prism of social history, because what we're offered is the whole of society is involved and attitudes are really laid out for us to observe, aren't they? You made a very moving and interesting programme about conscientious objectors and about people who deserted and their fate. And history is all about change, isn't it? That's what's so interesting about it, wouldn't you say?
Yes, and also I think going back in history, the reason people say, why do you want to do that again? We know all that. And the answer is you don't, and you never know it all. And you go back with a different set of attitudes or looking for different things, and you find something extraordinary. And the story of the conscientious objectors was a story about bravery.
Yeah.
And I was very moved by it and very taken by them. I mean, they were very, very bloody-minded people. And they had extraordinary powers of resilience and fortitude, and I ended up hugely admiring them.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, my family are all soldiers. I mean, they took the other line. They went and did what they were asked. For me, the First World War is always a sort of rediscovery, and I ended up writing a play about it for the BBC, about a trench newspaper called The Wipers Times.
The Wipers Times, yeah. Which, if you want the snapshot of how people were talking to each other in the trenches, and their humour and their concerns and their ability to use humour as well. I mean, it's the interesting thing is to use humour and satire to grapple with their situation. It couldn't be more illuminating.
Yes, and I mean, it's a trench newspaper. They found an old printing press in a basement in Ypres when they were looking for salvage to prop up trenches. And they decided, in a very British way, yes, look, there's an old printer. Let's produce a satirical magazine. We're on the front line in Ypres. We haven't got much on. Let's do some jokes.
Yeah.
And it was two fantastic men, Fred Roberts and Jack Pearson, who produced this magazine. And their jokes are very similar to the next 100 years of jokes. You know, there was a writer called Beach Thomas, who they hated, who they called Teach Bombus. And I thought, I would have put that in the eye any time, as I would all their material, because it's sort of much funnier than most of the stuff we do. And I loved finding that there were people who at the time were resolutely determined to be flippant, subversive and funny right in the face of death. And I loved it, and I thought they were amazing.
Yeah, laughing in the face of power, laughing in the face of adversity, wanting to cock a snook at the people in charge.
Absolutely. I mean, the classic Wipers Times, they ran an agony column. Someone wrote in saying, is it always wrong to shoot your senior officer? And the answer was no. There are often circumstances where it may be. And this was written by two men, one of whom got the MC at the Somme for conspicuous gallantry, and the other one won both an MC and a DSO.
Yeah.
These men weren't shirkers or cowards.
Yeah.
They were men who accepted what was happening to them and decided to find it funny.
It's amazing, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And my admiration for them overpowers me sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we've covered everything I want to talk about. I mean, finally, what of ambition? You know, if I was a grand inquisitor like David Frost, Michael Parkinson or Alan Titchmarsh, I'd have to say, what next for Ian Hislop? I mean, what, you became editor of Private Eye when you were 26. I mean, ambition can surely have nothing on offer for you.
I don't think it's the getting there. I mean, that's incredibly exciting. It's the staying there.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's because I have a very limited imagination and talent, but I have been allowed to edit Private Eye. I've been allowed to do a long-running panel show, Have I Got News For You, which I hugely enjoy.
Mm.
I get to write, I get to present stuff. I am incredibly lucky. And what I want to be is to continue doing those things. That's my ambition, to hang around.
Keep you uppy.
Yeah, keep you uppy. And, you know, there will come a moment, probably shortly after this recording, when people say, no, that's enough. You can go to Dave Jarvu.
Thanks to my guest, Ian Hislop. That was Chain Reaction with me, Al Murray, and my guest, Ian Hislop. The producer was Richard Morris, and it was a BBC Radio Comedy production.